You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
You can't win anything with kids.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
Open up the space though. The goal! Oh, fantastic stuff!
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Phoenix 5 show. Well, I say the Phoenix 5 show. It's only the Phoenix 2 today. I'm here, David Graham, hosting again. We've got Paul McGraw here. He's turned up. Hello, Paul. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good, mate. Good, thank you. Yourself?
Lovely. Yeah, not bad. We're recording this episode in June. Pubs are open. Lockdown's nearly finished. England are playing in World Cup qualifiers. Well, the friendlies anyway, against Romania. So three of the lads haven't turned up. But me and Paul are still here to bring you, hopefully, another great episode. So this week, as planned, we were going to talk about London clubs in the 1990s. Unfortunately, anyone listening that supports Millwall, Leyton Orient, Brentford, Barnet, and even my boys Fulham, I'm afraid we're going to have to push you to the side for a bit because you weren't in the Premier League in the 90s. So, yeah, well, maybe we'll do something for you guys in the future. And as for Watford and Luton, well, sorry, but Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire, it's just staying in London. So, yeah, we won't be focused on you. So we're going to basically be talking about London clubs. But just quickly, Paul, as I mentioned, Watford and Luton there, just a quick thing. You know, when you go on holidays or if you go to any part of the UK, and you speak, obviously, me and you are born and bred from London, like the rest of the guys. And you speak to people maybe from Liverpool, Birmingham, Newcastle, etc. And they clock your accent. I've had in the past people say to me, oh, I had a cousin who lived in Luton. Or I've got a friend that lives in Stevenage. That's London, isn't it? And I think, no, it's not. Have you ever come across that thing where people think anything outside of the Watford Gap is London?
I haven't, no. I don't think I have, actually. I think most of the time, assume I'm from London, and they don't actually say where in London. But when I lived in America, everyone who thought I lived, well, I was either Australian, and someone thought I was Egyptian from my accent. Honestly, that's how naive or how ill-informed some of the American people are on travel.
That's a weird. I like that. That's a weird one because you never told me that before. Obviously, me and Paul went, the other lads always grew up together, went to school together between, you know, 94 to 99. We grew up a lot of we went to school with a lot of Somali lads. So if the Americans said, "Oh, you've got a Somali accent," I'd get that, mate, but not the Egyptian accent. That's a weird one.
Rahim El Amali, what his name was.
Exactly. So okay. Obviously, me and Paul are here. We're both born and bred Londoners. Paul's from White City. I'm from East Acton. Anybody who doesn't know about that, just think of QPR and then you'll know. So the questions are, obviously, I'll go straight to Paul. So Paul, you lived closer to Loftus Road than any of us. You were literally a stone's throw away, but you opted to support Manchester United. Can you give us a bit of info why you supported Man United? What was behind that sort of thing, mate?
Yeah, well, so the first game I went to was QPR. It was QPR, I think West Ham was the first game I went to. I went to the England B games at Loftus Road. So yeah, that was like the first couple of games I went to. Then I went to a couple of Leyton Orient games, went to a Fulham game. So I've done a tour of a few of the London clubs, but my family's like history is based in sort of London, Paddington, that area as well. But I have a family member, my granddad used to take, or my great granddad took me to one of the games in Manchester years ago. And it kind of just went from there, really. I think it was a, compared to going to like a London club, like QPR and stuff, when we went to Old Trafford for the first time, it was massive. It was huge. It was such a different feel to it. And at the time I followed wrestling as well. And I used to go up to the wrestling events up in Manchester. So I've always liked Manchester as a city. And obviously they were winning things at the time. When you're 6-7, you know, when you first go to your first couple of games, you support teams that are winning things. So that obviously comes a part of it. And then funny enough, my my uncle had a divorce from his wife, remarried, and actually remarried Paul Scholes' mum. So I've always seemed to have these pulls of some sort of element of Manchester in my life. And
I lived in, obviously I mentioned East Acton. I mean, I lived probably about a 15-minute walk. You lived literally 2-minute walk. But didn't the roar of the crowds at Loftus Road, obviously they played obviously a lot, then obviously the night games were near at home, obviously maybe Saturday you wasn't in. Didn't that entice you to go think, well, actually I can hear that, they're in the Premier League. Well, shouldn't I just go and watch QPR? Just never appealed to you, mate, at all.
No, I did. I saw a few QPR games. My second cousin, I think it is, and he works at QPR. He's been there for, God, 30-odd years. And I used to go to, he got us tickets to the games. I used to go to the QPR school things, you know, the half terms. Soccer schools. I just never, yeah. No, I don't know what it was. There was never an affinity with them. I always remember on a Saturday, you could hear the crowd from our balcony when QPR scored, you could hear the crowd roar from that distance. And being in the ground, being older now, I prefer grounds like Queen's Park Rangers, where it is smaller and the atmosphere is completely different to these bigger soulless clubs that have, the atmosphere has disappeared from. But yeah. No, I just never had the inclination. I went to Fulham quite a bit. I done my coaching badges through Fulham. So I would say Fulham was closer to me than QPR in the end. When I done the coaching, they went down to the Motspur Park, done some training sessions there, saw a lot of the players. And I was probably 17, 18 at the time. And I grew up an affinity with that club due off the back of that. But I'll always be Man United is number one. But then the Spurs, I've been to quite a lot of the games there. I think I'm a Man United fan at heart, but I like football and I like different things. Leighton Orient, when I work there, I think when I work for clubs, I have an affinity with them. And, I get embedded in it and feel like, you know, this is a really a good club, and what they do for the community is quite important. QPR is one club that I will say had a fantastic community element to it from a very young age, I remember. And I went on to work with them in QPR in the community and a few other clubs. I think QPR in terms of their reach was probably the best that I worked with in the community side of things.
I had tickets for the soccer school, so going to watch QPR in the Premier League of the early days. My first game was actually QPR Sheffield United in the old First Division. But I also, my family's a big Sheffield Wednesday supporters. I used to go and watch them a couple of times, went Chelsea away, Southampton away. But as you say, the being forced into thing, it just never clicked with me. Even when they were in the Premier League, my dad started taking me to watch Fulham in 95-96 season, just to watch football. You know, I was football mad. He took me to watch a couple of games. And then back then as well, Jimmy Hill was the manager, Ian Branford was the manager, I remember. And there was people outside Fulham Football Club with buckets trying to raise money for Save the Club.
Yeah.
You know, they were in the third division. They were shit, basically. Paul just clicked. And my dad took me week in, week out. The second season we went, we got a season ticket, started going to away games, and I just never looked back. And it wasn't a Premier League sort of glory hunting thing, you know. It just felt right. Like you said, you're not forced into it. It's what feels right, so...
Do you not think it's interesting, though, in terms of glory hunters and all these other things and are they your local club and all this and that? Do you not find it funny that with football, it's one of the only things in life that you're not allowed to change? You can change jobs, you can change wives, you can change everything, your style, your personality, but you cannot change football clubs. I've always found that very bizarre, that it's such that people strike such an affinity with a club and such an affection for it. That it's tribal and you can't change clubs. And if you've supported it, I mean, let's look at it now on the realism side of it. Football is not with the EPL or whatever that Super League thing coming across. You've got to understand from another point of view, I think us as Britons and British people think very much like this is ours and we keep it and it's small. it's massive. Football is massive. These big clubs are humongous around the world. And do you think that a fan that lives in Sri Lanka but watches every single game because they're on every game is on TV, but they make a point to watch every single game, is less of a fan than someone that goes four or five times a season but watches most of the games on TV? There's a really big question, because a lot of people, the word glory hunter comes up. Man City fans will get a lot of it now. A lot of the young kids
wear
Man City shirts. But one, you don't want to be associated with failure. Why would you? Why would you want your children or anyone to support a failing club if they're going to support Man City? Obviously not for me, but you know, I just find it really interesting that people are not allowed to change clubs, and people that have that affinity, which is a bit more like, I like football, so I don't really support anyone, but I just like watching football. People find them strange.
I do. Certain people you speak to, I mean, you nail on the head there, Paul. Certain people I've worked through for the years, they have said, I'm neutral, but I like so-and-so. I think, well, you're not to be a neutral. You don't like so-and-so. You're neutral. So they have got an affinity to one club. Do you know what I mean? But to be fair, mate, before we move on to actual London club subject, I must say my attitude's changed during the years. When we was at school, you obviously been a Manchester United fan throughout school. You had it all the time. You know, you only support Man United because of winning things. You're not from Manchester. You should be supporting a London club. I believed in that years ago. But as I've got older, there's one thing that someone said to me once, and it's always stuck with me. So basically, it was to all Fulham supporters live in London.
No.
Someone said to me once, and I said no. And they said to me, have you got a problem with that? And I couldn't answer them. Mate, I couldn't answer them because they're supporting Fulham, whether they're coming from Norway, America, yeah, or just down the road, and I mean Clapham. No, I just couldn't answer it. And it's right.
It's true. It's not.
It is true, isn't it?
Because we think as kids, and even now some people say it in a bit of banter, but you know, if you said that you should support your local team and that's the only team that you support, and you put in a radius, then every team have a very small supporter base and it wouldn't be financially viable because you know, there's a friend of my granddad's that flies over from Norway called Maud, flies over for all the home QPR games or before COVID used to fly over. Now he's quite wealthy, so can do that. So him having some wealth has allowed him to come back to English games and watch football every other week.
Yeah.
But he's got friends that aren't as wealthy, big QPR fans, but they can't get over as much. Is one more of a supporter than the other because he can come and see the games? No. Mm. It's. I think this pressure goes behind it being a supporter that you have to go to all the games. I've got a friend who's a season ticket holder at Old Trafford. And obviously the Glazer thing. And I said, well, why don't you give it up? If you're that bothered, if you want to stop and make change, and this goes to Newcastle fans, Tottenham fans, all these people now are on the ground about fan base, give up your ticket. And what he said to me, and I thought, oh, that's fair enough. He said, I'd rather keep my ticket knowing that I go to the ground and I do not spend a penny more than I have to. I don't buy a beer in the ground. I don't buy a program. I don't buy a scarf. I use the pisser and that's about it. He said, because the minute I give this up, this won't go into circulation for another season ticket. This will go to a tourist that wants to come to the ground, buy a magazine, buy a scarf, buy a beer, buy a pie, and they're making more money from my seat. And I thought, that's very interesting.
Lovely points there, mate. It's a very 2021 attitude there. I can't disagree with anything you said because I totally agree. So let's jump back into the 90s when we were teenagers, when we were football mad. So we're from West London. So we'll start at West London, okay? Our manor, Mighty's Premier League. So West London was QPR and Chelsea. So we'll start with QPR. Season 92-93, when the season actually Premier League first started, QPR finished fifth above Spurs, Arsenal, Chelsea, Wimbledon and Palace. They're actually top London club. This question was actually to Lee, but obviously he's not here. So I'll give it to you and I'll answer it as well. It was a big thing back then, top London club. I mean, when you talk to QPR supporters today, Paul, they still mention top London club. When we talk about bragging rights, it meant a lot so much back then, doesn't it? And you know, we're not QPR fans ourselves, but for QPR to be top London club back then, for where they come from, it was a massive thing, wasn't it? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's still a big thing now, I think, for London clubs. Back then, I don't think it's any more important.
I mean, QPR finished above Liverpool that season as well. I mean, it was a massive coup above Arsenal, above Chelsea.
Yeah, they had a good squad at that stage. They had a really good squad. We spoke to Andy Sinton and he mentioned some of the players that they had there, but they were a selling club. Every year they would sell a player to kind of progress. Yeah. I think that, you know, was it sustainable? Possibly, if they kept everyone together, could they have pushed them, been the top London club for more than one season? Yeah, possibly.
They had Les Ferdinand, Andy Sinton, Bradley Allen, David Barnsley, who made Player of the Year 92-93, Clive Wilson, who's mentioned quite a lot in this pod, Ray Wilkins. He was a lazy player, but he's a fan favourite at QPR. I mean, like you said, they did have a really good side. I think it's when they sold Les in 95 to Newcastle. Would you say that was sort of the start of the end?
Yeah, I think 95, 96, I would also say was the start, not the start, but when bigger transfer fees started happening. And I think you started to see clubs like QPR, whose gate receipts would have been smaller than, you know, Arsenal and everyone else. They've always had a very small capacity at the ground.
I think it was about 19,000, isn't it? Tops, yeah. I think.
Yeah, it might be that. It might be less. I'm not too sure now. Was it a surprise? I don't know. I think if you look at the Arsenal team at that stage, I don't think there was a... I think they were going for a bit of a dodgy period themselves. Spurs were just Spurs. It wasn't... Where did they finish the following season? I think they finished 15th the following season, if I'm right.
I don't think it was top clinical after. But the players I've mentioned, obviously, like you said, they were a good side. But once Ferdinand left and the other, obviously, Sinton left, Wilson left, a lot of them went to Spurs, didn't they? They didn't really go on to better things, did they, bar Ferdinand? So they had, what I've looked into, they got 6 million for Ferdinand. They never really replaced him, have they, even up to this day? They were linked with Roberto Baggio. I mean, you can laugh if you like, but they were linked with him. They signed John Spencer and Gavin Peacock, but they spent a lot of money. They spent that 6 million on a lot of shit, Paul. Yeah. I'll give you the list of players and you tell me what you think. Ned Zelic, Simon Osborne, Mark Hatley, Gregory Goodridge, I think he was from Torquay or somewhere, Lee Charles and Mike Sheeran. I mean, to me, what do you reckon? That's just a waste of money, you know? I mean, apparently Kevin Gallen and Dicchio were prolific at youth level, but they were no replacement for Les Ferdinand during that early 90s, mid-90s period.
But I think that was the thing when you get, you know, at the time £6 million and you go and either do one or two things. You spend £6 million on buying a replacement, or you buy seven players for £6 million and hope that two of them are decent, because you know, then you think, well, if two of them are decent, we can sell one further on down the line, we'll recoup some more money and we'll reinvest that again. I think they always reinvested the money they got, but maybe the transfer policy or the managers coming in just weren't as good as getting the signings than they once had. And then when you lose Les Ferdinand, he was getting, 18, 20 goals a season?
Oh, he's prolific, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Prolific.
It's very difficult for clubs to find someone to replace
that
amount of goals with, and it's always going to struggle after there.
I mean, they had Jerry Francis for X amount of years. Unfortunately, it wasn't Francis that took him down, it was Ray Wilkins. This is where you might want to rant, not so much rant, but this is Man United involved here, Paul. They got relegated in 1996, as I said, with Ray Wilkins in charge. We're talking Fergie time. It wasn't the game that sent them down. Cantona's equaliser, I reckon it was like 10 minutes into extra time. It's not in only QPR supporters. When you talk to other people about that are knowledgeable about the 90s, like we are as a group, that seems to pop up. Obviously, it's not Cantona's fault. It's not Fergie's fault. The referee added nearly 10 minutes on. Do you think that was a major factor, or would you say just QPR wasn't good enough over those 38 games or however many was in that season,
mate? Listen. No one gets relegated on one game.
That's what I mean, yeah.
I mean, people say it all the time, no one wins a league you can look back and go, oh, if we beat them, yeah, maybe, but then you might have not won the next game or whatever. You know, that's why the league is the hardest thing to go stay up in or to win, because you've got to do it for 38 games, not 37.
Consistency, yeah.
Got to be over, you know, there's loads of options. You know, the argument could be if they got them points, maybe they would have pushed them on to go and support something, you know, to go on a little run, but it's unproven. You can't base it on what could have happened, unfortunately, in football. Otherwise, we could all been, you know, Premier League winners and European champions and whatnot. Did it play a factor? Yeah, potentially, because I don't know what the run was like after that, but I'm assuming...
It's the first nail in the coffin, wasn't it? And then I think of the game, I'm not sure, Paul, but there wasn't like that. Well, I don't think that was the game that sent them down, but I think maybe the game or the game after. So it was like the start of the end. But I think the major issue was the 10 minutes, as QPR fans say, that was added on. It's called Fergie time, isn't it? Yeah. But obviously Ferguson wasn't refereeing the game, so it's quite a bit of a cliche. It doesn't mean anything.
No, not just that. I think the other thing is you've got to bear in mind, I don't remember the game in terms of the 90 minutes. Of course I don't. But how many injuries were there? How many subs were there? It's very easy. You know, they had 9-10 minutes, but you can't remember, was someone injured at one point? Yeah. Down for 5 minutes. You know, you only remember the bits that you want to remember of selective memory, unfortunately. But no, I think they went down. I don't think they really recovered. I don't think they've ever recovered from that relegation, personally. Yeah. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I'm sure the QPR fans have them. We've got a chance to speak to Ian Dowie, hopefully, in a later episode. The five-year plan DVD, when that came out, and I watched that with Flavio and brother, the other guy, I can't remember his name now, and it just showed you what shambles that the club was. I mean, it was, you know, before Amazon had this behind-the-scenes thing, go and check the five-year plan out on Amazon or try and purchase it somewhere on eBay, because it shows you how bonkers running a football club is. It really shows you the crazy side of football.
Never seen Clare's goal for QPR against Barnsley. That overhead kick, how far out it was. You must admit, even if you're any QPR fan, that was a fantastic goal, wasn't it? I think it's probably, when I pick QPR goals, that's number one. When I pick best goals I've seen in my life, it touches, it's got to be in the top 10 for me, Paul. Yeah. Could you think of another better QPR goal as we're talking about QPR? Well, is that topic for you? That's the best one I think I've seen. I think Roy Regley done one against Leeds in the early days. Sinclair's tops it for me.
Yeah, it was technically, it was superbly executed. It was a great goal. It's one of those goals that will always be shown. So QPR will always have that in terms of TV presence. If you ever talk about top goals in football, I think that goal comes out of most people that like football. It's just a, definitely. You know, I don't think
Messi scores it. Ronaldo scores it. We don't shut up about it, do we? That's the thing.
Yeah. But I think it's had a lot of time out of it. And I also think that when you're talking of like executions, I don't think I've seen a better execution of a bicycle kick rather since.
I agree.
I've never seen a bicycle kick hit so well and so precise.
On that distance as well. It's the distance that does it for me.
Yeah, definitely. 100%.
Lovely. So we'll move on to Chelsea then, just down the road from us. Early part of the 90s. They were promoted to the top tier in 1990. They had players like Kerry Dixon, Gordon Dewey, Mick Harford up top. What do you actually remember about early Chelsea, Paul? Because early Chelsea, I remember, was a nothing club, mate. They never came into the conversation. It was always QPR, Arsenal, not even Spurs, QPR, Arsenal, really. Early days, just say from 1995. What do you remember about Chelsea, mate?
I don't remember much about them until, I would say, their FA Cup success. Which are, you know, that run with Di Matteo, Petrescu, yeah. Player managers with Viali and Ruud Gullit.
Do you remember Hoddle coming in just before that?
Yeah. I remember that. Obviously, Ken Bates was quite a well-known chairman at the time.
Yeah.
The feuds he was having with the fans, with the ground. It's weird with Chelsea because I know everyone should hate them, and we all hate them to a point because it's the money of the modern side of things. But I did always used to like watching them play. Was it Autoglass was their sponsor, wasn't it, back in the mid-90s?
No, Autoglass, yeah. They had Coors as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
They had a couple of sponsors. Just the beginning of the 90s, just to start off with, before we move on to the latter stage. I'd say, I can't remember anything of them really, mate.
No, nothing. When
you talk about West London, it was always QPR for me. Back in the early 90s, you know. Chelsea weren't really mentioned. Like I just mentioned, we've got Kerry Dixon, Gordon Dewey, Mick Harford. When you think of Chelsea, back in the they don't really come in your head, do they?
I think that
obviously Glenn Hoddle came in from Swindon.
Yeah.
Go on, sorry, mate.
But I think it comes into play that also the difference when you look at QPR and you look at Chelsea, you know, everyone goes to the attraction of London. What Chelsea did very well was when they signed imports. Because if you look at QPR's...
Yeah.
Obviously, the Premier League, they went down, so it was a bit difficult. But Chelsea was
one... Chelsea kicked on, didn't it, really? Yeah. On that stage, when QPR... Yeah. Nothing to do with QPR, but that's when they kicked on. Yeah, go on.
That's when QPR went down, they kicked on, and that's when they were one of... If you think of foreign signings for clubs, the two clubs that come to my head at the mid-90s and the one London club is Chelsea. You know, they had a lot of foreign people come over. Like I can remember predominantly being like, you know, as I said, Dan Petrescu.
Sola, Desai, Leboeuf, Deschamps, yeah. Laudrup, Panucci, Petrescu. The list goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah, very, very heavy on foreigners in that period. I could probably, if I had to name 10 Chelsea players in that period, I don't think I'm even then thinking of many English players in that first 11.
Yeah, that's a great point, Paul, because I was just going to come on to that. Chelsea were the first side ever in English football to name a first 11 that were non-English. Was during the 1990s.
Ah, I thought it was Arsenal. So that's interesting.
No, it was Chelsea.
Right.
It was Chelsea. Yeah, Chelsea. And that's when they started winning a few trophies as well. I don't remember how much, well, I had a look in and I can't remember. They were quite successful, actually, from the mid-90s going on to the late-90s. It's before Abramovich even arrived. They had two FA Cups, a League Cup, a Cup Winners' Cup and a Super Cup. But this is where you come in. You like the money side of it. Even at that stage, when they had all those foreign imports, they still didn't, there were no match for Manchester United, even no match for Arsenal. They won those trophies, but they were still struggling financially. Ken Bates was in charge. And this is where you're going to take over, mate. A helicopter came over to buy from Russia to buy White Hart Lane. A certain Mr. Sugar said no. Abramovich had a look down. And what happened, mate?
Well, I think if I'm right, I think the first thing he flew over was Wembley. And I'm sure, if I got this wrong, please correct me. I'm sure he did. And he was like, what's that? And they was like, oh, no, you can't buy that. It's the National Stadium. Mm-hmm. They was like, but, you know, and he's like, the Tottenham thing. And then it was like, okay, I can't have them. Show me around. He saw Stamford Bridge and said, I'll have that, more or less. And
I remember that being in the Evening Standard poll.
And I'm sure the deal was concluded in something silly, like in a couple of days. It was like very quickly done. Yeah, but what Bates did do, which I think was very wise at the time, is he sold everything to Abramovich, but the actual playing surface, the pitch, is owned by Chelsea fans. There's this kind of trust set up. So at any stage, I don't know if they have a yearly lease or what it is. So when go back to the Super League, when that got brought up, I think this is and he's been trying to buy it off them for years, but they haven't managed to secure the voting rights to buy it. But I think, that's a big game changer when he came into the Premier League. I know Holland, if he was here, would be going about Man United bought the league constantly. But again, there's a difference between buying the league, like a Jack Walker who used personal wealth to buy a league.
Like we've said before, Paul, sorry to butt in, mate, but, Jack Walker did throw, even though when you look back at what Walker spent, it's peanuts, isn't it, compared to this day and age. Yeah. But he did throw money. He gave Dalglish basically an open checkbook, and Dalglish won the league with it. People seem, I'm not a Blackburn fan, not a United fan, but people seem to forget that Dalglish did have an open checkbook and he spent it wisely and Blackburn won the Premier League.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I'm not going to go back, I would go back to the thing, but same thing, it wasn't, that was a single person who ran the club who threw money at it. Mm. And Roman came in. And as I said in the earlier ones, it was like Championship Manager. It was like they were linked to everybody and they could literally sign anybody, it felt like. But they actually didn't really sign anybody of note, really, because no one wanted to go there. It wasn't like that, they weren't winning things. The history isn't there to be like, oh, come to Chelsea. It was just the London pool. But then they obviously started getting some bigger names later on, like the Shevchenkos and players like that. But it was exciting. It was really exciting. It's very exciting as a neutral, I can imagine. All of a sudden, there's this new team in town. That, as you said, they had been winning things leading up to this. They weren't. Man City's money comes. Man City was, League One or whatever at the time. And there was a lot of difference in the club. Chelsea had some sort of winning mentality there, a good cup team. And they just needed a bit of a push to show what they could achieve.
Yeah, it sounds like Bates was spending, what's the word I'm looking for? He was spending, when you haven't got the money, I can't think of it at the top of my head, but you're spending among your means.
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Beyond,
they were struggling. They were winning trophies, like you said, but they were struggling financially. And that's when Abramovich took that debt away and then transformed it into the noughties. It's quite a strange situation. So no more on Chelsea, really, but I want to ask you, in your opinion, Paul, during the 1990s, who was Chelsea's best player, would you say, from your memory? During 1990 to 1999, who stood out for you? Would you say he was quality? He was.
There's a lot. There's a lot of players there in that period.
Zola sticks out for me.
Well,
the first one that comes to my head in the 1990s is Zola.
Yeah, but I think he sticks out for everyone. And I think everyone knows Zola was great. But I really like Frank Leboeuf. And I don't think he gets mentioned enough. When you think of great...
Because he's a defender, I think.
Premier League defenders. We've done underrated. We've done rate 11s. He doesn't get mentioned. I think Frank Leboeuf was fantastic for Chelsea.
Yeah, good shout, yeah.
There's a lot. Yeah, I don't know. I think they just... I always, as I said, I enjoy watching Chelsea play. I always thought they had a bit of flair around them. There was a bit of the continental side about them. They were a bit of a bonkers club, as I said, with a player-manager situation, which was...
Well, they had two, didn't they? They had Hoddle and then they had Hullett.
Yeah.
And then Vialli as well. So I think Vialli was player-manager. So you had three in a 10-year period, didn't you?
Yeah.
That's crazy. You don't hear of player-managers anymore. So, yeah.
Oh. So, no, Leboeuf I really enjoyed watching, but obviously the Zola was just... phenomenal in that period in terms of, and again, I think it's interesting because we've on our WhatsApp group, we've spoken about Bergkamp and Cantona in terms of technical and all this other stuff. We've argued back and forth in the Hall of Fames. If Zola had won a league, would Zola be in the same bracket as the Bergkamps and Cantonas?
Good question. If you're asking me personally, you know what I'm like, Paul, I do study players technically. That's one thing I do look, especially their first touch. And I've got to say, no, not for me. Zola was fantastic. He's one of the Premier League greats. But if you ask me to pick between Bergkamp and Zola, Bergkamp pisses all over him, to be honest. Bergkamp had that something extra. No, he really does. You know, I'm not an Arsenal fan at all. I'm a Fulham supporter. I've got soft spots for different players, soft spots for different clubs. Arsenal isn't one of them. But Bergkamp, he's different. He's different gear. Well, he was different gear. Before we move on to a different part of London, I just want to ask you, stick with Chelsea just a bit longer. Did you ever go to the old Stamford Bridge? When I say the old Stamford Bridge, it's still the same ground, but it's completely different. I went there with my uncle back in 94, 95. He took me Sheffield Wednesday, Chelsea away, and it was an open end. So you had the shed. I can't remember the Matthew Arden stand. It's very open. You had a dog track around the end. You had cars around there. It's completely different. But you know what I'm like, mate? I'm very traditional, and I love that. I love the terracing. It was a completely different atmosphere. Did you ever go to the bridge? I'm guessing you've been to the bridge, what it's like now. Did you ever go to the bridge before?
No, I've never been. I've never been to the bridge. It's the only, not the only London club.
Okay.
Because of White Hart Lane, Old Stadium, the Old West Ham Stadium, the Charlton, Fulham, QPR.
Oh, good. So when we have to talk about those clubs, you can talk about it. Yeah, I just assumed you've been to Stamford Bridge.
That's the only one I haven't
been to. I think they're very samey now, mate, but the Old Stamford Bridge, people slag it off, you know, because it's old-fashioned. That character years ago.
I didn't enjoy my time there. Character years ago. That's the difference now. Yeah. Going back to my earlier comment about being a business, the new White Hart Lane, it's different. The new
it's impressive, isn't it? But it's not.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Ain't old school, is it?
They're sporting stadiums now.
Yeah,
I agree. They're not football stadiums. They are geared up. Host gigs and concerts, and it's about the functionality and the practicality of it now. There's nothing like a, you know, I was telling Lauren about that when I went to Old Trafford and the vast amount of fans and how I got that feel of it, of a big feeling compared to now. It's completely different. And even now, if you go to Old Trafford, it's a completely different atmosphere than it was. And the ground hasn't changed massively. It's a bit more derelict, I would say, now. But in terms of, it's also the people going to watch the games now.
Mm.
It is more of a tourist thing. And where you go, that's a massive factor in it. And tourists aren't going to necessarily go there shouting and screaming. They're going to go there and watch.
Unfortunately, no. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Okay, lovely. We move on to North London. There's only two teams to talk about, really. Sorry, Barnett. But it's Arsenal and Spurs. Obviously, we've done loads of episodes where you and Dave have argued about Man United and Arsenal. I won't say you've got a hatred for Arsenal, but you're not too keen on them. So let's start with Arsenal anyway. So United, two league titles, two FA Cups, one League Cup, one Cup Winners' Cup, and three Charity Shields. So it's nine pieces of silverware in a 9-year period under two managers. You've mentioned in the past, I think we've done the Champions League episode, you mentioned you thought George Graham was a better manager than Arsene Wenger. So obviously George Graham was early 90s. Do you still stick by that, Paul? Do you think he was more successful? Because the 1-0 to the Arsenal thing, they were very boring to watch. But looking at the trophies won, as you stated in the past, he does seem more successful when it comes to silverware.
Yeah, we spoke to Winterburn, and obviously he had an opinion on both managers as well. And I think, I don't know, I wouldn't say George Graham was maybe the word better manager is different. They're different styles of manager. Mm. But I think Graham's way was very effective, won a lot of trophies. When you look at Wenger's period, he had a very long period there. And I think...
6 to the 90s, though, that's what I'm saying. Just during that period, the 90s period.
Oh, well, they're
Graham. 2000.
Yeah, Graham's more successful. I think hands down, Graham's more successful. I think you're talking about changing cultures in clubs. Yeah, Arsene Wenger wins it hands down. You know, if you have Pep Guardiola now at Man City, obviously he's won more than Wenger's won in his period already. Do you know what I mean? In terms of leagues, he's already done that. What Wenger took X amount of years to do, he's done it in a very short period.
Yeah.
If Pep comes in his first season, doesn't win the league, which happened, But the style of football you could see in the following year, the style of football was there, but didn't win the league. The third season, they're phenomenal. They win the league. Then for three or four seasons, they don't win the league. Pep Guardiola would be heralded as his great manager, and he would be whatever it would be, you would lord over him. But yes, his style of football may be revolutionary, but it doesn't make him the best manager. Not saying this and Pep and Wenger are comparable. It's very different. But I think you look at what Wenger did in the 90s and early 2000s was very, very good. But you can't just judge people on half their career. You've got to look at things for a career. And you've got to be successful for a career, not for 6 years of a career and then 12 years.
No, I understand that. But as you're keeping it 90s, let's take a look at this. Then, no, I agree with what you're saying, Paul. But in 94-95, Arsenal finished 12th. I mean, that's low, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that was 94-95. Obviously, at the beginning of the decade, you've mentioned it before, rubbed Dave's nose in it. They got knocked out to Wrexham in the FA Cup. George Graham was sacked over allegedly bungs, etc. against Norwegian players, Danish players, whatever they were.
Dan Olsen,
Riyad came in, wasn't very successful, but he did bring Dennis Bergkamp. So Wenger came in, I think it was 95 or 96, and did change the game. But as we just focused on London clubs, not so much their achievements and stuff, let's talk about the derby days. Spurs versus Arsenal. Now, I want to have a little bit of a say about this because bragging rights to me, I mean, I live in Wolverhampton now. And bragging rights up here are massive, Paul, when it comes to Wolverhampton Wanderers and West Bromwich Albion. I've heard of bragging rights in the past. QPR, Chelsea's not really major. Arsenal, Spurs back in the 90s and before I'm a big, etc. They, mate, up here, they fucking hate each other. They really hate each other. And because they're so close and local, it is when you go to work the next day, you do have those bragging rights. And I do think it's a fan thing. I do not think in this day and age, it ain't a player thing. And I do blame that on the foreign influence. It's not their fault because they don't understand the English game. They just going out to play another game means fuck all to them. But bragging rights, let's go keep it in the 90s. How, I mean, you're a Manchester United fan. So for Manchester United to beat Manchester City or Liverpool, that's massive. In the 90s, how big was bragging rights for Spurs to beat, especially Spurs to beat Arsenal or Arsenal to beat Spurs, either way. Well, obviously Arsenal were the bigger club. How big was it in the 90s and how much has it sort of, what's the word, degraded in today's age, you know? But start with the 90s for me, mate.
It's difficult, I don't know. So bragging rights for me, obviously being a Man United fan in a London school with QPR and Arsenal fans and Liverpool fans in our class and stuff like that. So the bragging rights for us was beating that team. So I know bragging rights are generally about your rivalries with London clubs.
Rival, yeah.
Clubs. But I use it as that. And that was, being in school, it was important to beat those clubs. In terms of what it meant to fans back then, I do think it still has a very high position now. I do think it is very important. It's not as important to some of them because I think the fan base is more global now. So you don't have that going into work. You know, in the 90s, you probably say if you went into work, you worked at around the North London area, you probably work mostly with either Arsenal fans, Tottenham fans, or a Barnet fan generally. Yeah. Whereas now you go into work, you've got 15 clubs that are supported in a small space. So I don't necessarily think you've got that immediate impact of rivalry. But families, if you've got different family members that support different halves of London or Manchester or Liverpool, whatever it would be, and I think that's huge. And I think players do have a massive feel for it still, if they're local. I would say in the United with Rashford and McTominay and players like that, they know what it's like to want to win a derby or win against Liverpool. And I think it's the same for, well, I don't know about Arsenal in the past as much. Having, again, not having a lot of British players, it does make it more difficult. I think that like Harry Kane will know the importance of trying to beat an Arsenal, you know, to what it means. And when we spoke to Ralph Fox and he said about working man's clubs and so
yeah,
I think
it's a good example, Ralph Fox, yeah. Even though he wasn't a Londoner, he understood what it meant. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So I think it's, I don't think it's not as important now, but again, I just think it's, there's so many more avenues to respond to things now. If you look at it like that, you go on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, you could be hit from left, right and center if your team gets beat by your rivals. You're in fan groups or whatever it would be, or football Facebook chats. So I think it's still there, or WhatsApp groups.
Yeah.
I think it is still there. I think it was important. I don't think it was any less important necessarily. I just think the importance of it has changed because the working man clubs are not there as much now. The souls of the clubs, so those local fans aren't there as much. But everyone still wants to win their the local derby. You know, I think it still means a lot, hell of a lot to a lot, hell of a lot of people.
Definitely. So let's move on to the other side of North London. Let's talk about a bit about Spurs. They started the decade with a trophy. That was the FA Cup win against Forest, famous Gazza one. They ended it with a trophy as well, a boring 1-0 win against Leicester, I think, Alan Nielsen goal. But in between that, Paul, there was really nothing. I mean, I don't like jumping into 2021, but not a lot has changed really, has it? Stick with the 90s. What's your thoughts on Spurs in the 90s? Because I'm guessing, like me, there's not a lot, a bit like Chelsea, there's not a lot to report on them, really. You know, they, I mean, they had, before you answer, sorry, mate, they had eight managers in that from 1990 to 1999, they had eight managers and two caretaker managers. Whereas the London, North London rivals, Arsenal, only had the two. I mean, they won a couple of trophies, but nothing to match Arsenal. It's pretty dire, really, isn't it? You know? Now, well, we at school, we always used to speak about Manchester United, Arsenal, London club, QPR, early days, London club, Spurs, Chelsea, early days. We spoke more about Juventus, let's be fair.
Yeah, no, agreed. But I think, but I do think they had some quality players in the 90s, and they had a quality team, but they just... Again, was it the ownership with Sugar being in control, who just liked to be front and centre of things and seems to, from what we've seen of him, likes to have an argument with people. You know, Klinsmann, Sheringham.
I was just going to get onto the Klinsmann thing. Do you think... the Klinsmann, they signed him from Monaco. It was great up front with Sheringham for a season. I think we mentioned him in our Deadly Duos episode. But do you think the lack of support from behind, from the midfield... Do you think that sort of spoiled it? But obviously, Klinsmann is a world-class... Well, he was a world-class striker at that time. More or less, that's rely on Teddy.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's hard.
You know what
it?
I mean? It's...
How do you... You know, just getting Klinsmann, you could argue at the time, was the best, one of the best forwards...
Oh, it's a coup, wasn't it? Massive coup.
Yeah. So you build on that. But again, it was only one season and he moved on. So...
He came back, didn't he? And he was nowhere near the... He was more or less finished, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He peaked at 90, didn't he? Let's be fair. So
yeah, but you know, if they managed to keep him for longer than a season, who knows what could have happened with the right players behind him? I don't know. I like Tottenham. I've got a close friend or a friend of mine that's a season ticket holder. I've got a few friends that are season ticket holders at Tottenham. I think most of my mates are Tottenham fans. I've got about six Spurs fans. And they're saying the same thing. It's just they're a balmy club. I mean, Ferguson summed it up when we went 3-0 down, and he said, "What's happening, lads? You know, it's Spurs." I think that was kind of what people saw of them.
Spursy, they call it, don't they?
Spursy, yeah, they're doing a pawn of Spursy. Yeah. Decent cup team.
Yeah,
didn't push on, but again, the money in the game has a factor in that, because you did start to see, obviously, in the 90s, I think they had some good players, but again, would you argue they were a selling club? Would you say in that period?
I just don't think they were good enough, Paul. I was just trying to think. Some of the signings were dire, weren't they? I mean, they had Jason Dazil, Ramon Vega, Paolo Tramazzani. I mean, he's a good example for you. Sugar was no... Was it David Dean at the time? Arsenal was, wasn't it, Dean? When they got Wenger, their equivalent was Christian Gross. We've mentioned him on the pod a few times with his bus ticket, his train ticket, sorry. He was no match for Wenger. And a famous quote was, well, you laugh at this one. This is a corker. When Arsenal signed Dennis Bergkamp, apparently, well, it's not apparently, it's fact. I've actually seen it come out of his mouth. Alan Sugar turned around and sort of shrugged his shoulder and said, well, they signed Dennis Bergkamp, but we've signed Chris Armstrong. That's to say, we've got Chris Armstrong. Are you comparing Dennis Bergkamp to Chris Armstrong? Jeez, no wonder Spurs didn't win fuck all. You know what I mean? So, well, they didn't dominate like United or Arsenal did. So, yeah, it's... They were a bit like a poor relative. And as to add to that, Paul, before we move on to another part of London, Spurs kit supplier in the 90s was Pony. What's the Cockney rhyme slang for Pony?
It's all, didn't it?
Pony and trap crap. So I think that's, you know, there's some Spurs up really, didn't it? Unfortunately, Dave Noll ain't this. He would have ripped into them. But yeah, he's more chested than a beer tonight. But never mind. So we'll move on to the East End. Sorry, Leighton Orient. we're still yet to see him in the Premier League. But in the 90s, it was only West Ham United. I think they got promoted in 92. So, Paul, what's your first... When you think of West Ham, what's the first... In the 90s, what's the first thing you think of, mate?
Harry Redknapp.
Yeah, I was going to say the same. Redknapp straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah, go on.
I think wheeling, dealing, ducking, diving, youth system, transfers, you know, Joe Cole, Rio Ferdinand, Frank Lampard, Paolo Di Canio going there.
Well, you summed it up lovely, mate. Really, you've took words out of my mouth. You went from youth academy, so we're talking Rio Ferdinand, Michael Carrick, Joe Cole, Frank Lampard, and then you talk about signings. He signed a load of shit, didn't he? Danny, Boogers, Radichoy, Futre, Porfirio. It's a catch 22 system, but yeah. And then obviously he did sign some decent players, like you just mentioned, Di Canio, Hartson, Mark Vivien, Faraway. But yeah, no, sorry, mate. Yeah, carry on. The folks at West Ham, they're a bit of a wheeling dealing club, like you said.
Yeah, I think that West Ham, I mean, that they again, it goes back to that thing, doesn't it? And he's come out in the past and said, if we kept them players, we could have won a league, which is all great and well, but
I don't believe that, do you?
No, because you develop differently in different clubs. I don't. That's where they would have won a cup potentially. Yeah, and they might have finished in the top four potentially. Yeah, but would those players have gone on to be the same players that they stayed at West Ham and been pushed at the West Ham level, as opposed to going on to a Chelsea and Arsenal, Liverpool, Man United, whatever it would be? No, is the answer to that. They wouldn't have done. Yeah, great history with West Ham.
Do you think the players you've met, not so much forget the flops, because they were a major part. Do you think it's weird that they were always bottom off? That, I mean, you mentioned that Harry Redknapp said they could have won a league, they could have won a cup. But when we were kids, mate, when we were in the '90s, they was always bottom off. They were always in with your Coventries, weren't they? Always in with your Southamptons, your Barnsleys even, when they were in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Why do you think they just didn't? I mean, Harry Redknapp, do you think it's a character thing with Redknapp, or do you think he was, not being harsh, overrated? Because until he went to Portsmouth, I don't really remember him doing anything as in silverware or qualifying for Europe, you know?
No, I wouldn't say he's overrated at West Ham, not at all. I wouldn't say that.
You know what I mean, though, by achievement?
Yeah, but remember, back in, I would say, the mid-90s onwards, when you started getting the one-team league, because you had Arsenal, Liverpool, then you had Man United, it was kind of Man United winning it, and Arsenal coming to challenge. I think from 95 onwards, it was difficult for clubs to push up and to make that next step, because everyone was strengthened behind, and top clubs did come in and take players, you know, so they did have a lot of players there that would get sold, and then they would bring players in that wouldn't be anywhere near as good. They had Repka,
yeah.
I mean, they had some good players there, and they did.
That's my point I'm trying to make to you. You said about Redknapp saying they could have won a League Cup, but the players that they did have, because they sound a lot of shit, but they had a lot of good youth talent, and they did sign decent players as well. That's what I'm saying. Do you think Harry Redknapp was slightly overrated? Did his character play a big part? Do you remember we spoke the other day about Jimmy Bullard's character and Adam Miller? He said about his character played a massive part. They looked at his character before they looked at his football ability. Do you think people in the 90s looked at Redknapp's character more than they looked at his management ability? That's all I meant, mate.
I don't know, because you'd have to ask a West Ham fan, but if you said to a West Ham fan in the 90s, what would be classed a successful season, it was finishing...
Staying up, truly. Yeah, I agree.
Would be success and having a decent cup run. And if any West Ham fans, I know Jamie, a friend of mine, is listens to the show. If I'm wrong, obviously you can correct me on this, mate. But I think they were a good club to watch. They were a good local club. They were entertaining to watch. They had a decent cup run here and there. They had some very good individual talents. They had some good teams at stages. But again, you say a bit bottom mid-table, the bottom half of the table.
Well, they were, weren't they? Let's be fair.
Well, that's probably what they were at the time.
That's
the thing. Again, it's 20 teams in the league, and they had some good finishes there at West Ham as well in that period. They did finish, I think, eighth for one season, and or was it ninth in one season? And obviously that Hearts and Kitson combination, when they were in the dire straits, they came in and scored a bundle of goals to keep them up.
Yeah, I just thought it was at a level. I think Harry Redknapp sort of, it sounds weird, but peaked at Portsmouth, you know?
Oh, I think you've done. No, I don't think he peaked at Spurs. I think
no.
He had a fantastic run at Spurs. Arguably, I think from the players that he had, he had a fantastic run at Spurs. And I think they.
No trophies. This is the CV, isn't it? Again, this is what we talk about.
Yeah, but trophies
at Portsmouth. It's a hard one, isn't it? You know, because moving on to South London, we had Crystal Palace, Charlton, and Wimbledon. But we start with Charlton. You managed. Mentioned when a manager leaves, everything falls to shit. I think Kirbishley at Charlton. They had one season. They had one season in the '90s. Don't get confused with their yo-yo in the noughties. In the '90s, they won the playoffs in 1998, and we all remember that. So Alan Kerbishley in the 90s with the Addicts had one season. Unfortunately, they got relegated. I remember Clive Mendonca, Richard Rufus. I'm surprised I didn't put him in underrated at the time under Richard Rufus. But when I mentioned Kerbishley there, your eyes lit up. So if you've got an affection for Alan Kerbishley, because it sounds like when he left, Charlton went to shit and they're still in the shit in 2021, mate.
Yeah, I tell you what that is. And again, speaking, obviously it's difficult to be neutral. I've met Kerbishley twice. Lovely man. Both times, gave a lot of time. Very enthusiastic. And I've heard a lot of about what he's... Okay, I'm going to use Burnley as a modern-day example because it's a very good comparison to use. Burnley came up for a season, went down. They used that money to invest in the training ground, into the stadium, got back up the following season, and they've been a very good club now. Now...
Stable, yeah.
Stable, that's the word.
Yeah.
Now people might question, where are Burnley going? What are their ambitions? Do we need to find a new manager? Is it time to move on? And that's what happened at Charlton. He then got forced out. I think he left and then went to West Ham at some stage. But it was almost like, well, he's taken them where he can go. It's time to move on. And sometimes you just keep with someone because you know what they're doing is a good job. And you're not a top five or top 10 or a Premier League club. You're going to go up and go down. And I think he's... You think the top English manager at the time, he was linked to the England job at one stage.
Yeah, I was going to say that, but that was more into the noughties. That's why I sort of stay clear of it. He was linked to.
It's difficult to just base it on 90s because that is, you know, in terms of memories, a lot of mine are mid to late 90s to early 2000s. And I think he came out of the game for a period of time.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, he was forgotten about. And he couldn't get back in. It was like taking... I think he was at Fulham. Did he go to Fulham as a technical director?
Yeah, he was there for a bit, mate. I don't think it was like manager.
Director, I think he was.
Yeah, that's right. He was.
No, I don't know. I think Charlton were interesting to watch again.
Definitely.
Yo-yo club, as you said, in the 2000s, in the 90s, they got up. And it's difficult as well to come up from that league. And
I think the playoff final in that decade in the 90s is what you're remembering for, didn't you?
Yeah.
Against Sunderland. Michael Gray missed them getting promoted. It's probably, I mean, we haven't done an episode on it. I know you're keen to do one.
Yeah.
It's something we haven't really spoke about, but I think anybody of our age and before, when you think about playoffs in the 90s, that's the one that comes to your head, didn't it, really? It's a fantastic game. What a game it was. Unfortunately, someone had to lose it. It was Sunderland, you know?
Yeah, playoffs in the 90s, we've spoken about it. We're brilliant. You know, 4-4s, 4-3s.
Yeah.
The Swindon saga with them going up, but then not because there was some bribes were done or some match fixing of some sort. Mm. And you had, you know, the Charlton game. Yeah, man, it was brilliant. But you knew again back in the day when these teams come up. Most of the time, I mean, it was quite often. I might be wrong about having the stats in front of me, but how often teams, the three teams that went up, two went down. If not the first season, the second. Within 2 seasons, the three teams that come up, two, if not all three, have gone down within 2 years of coming up because it's a ruthless league. You know, you always come up and you get a surprise package, Sheffield United in recent times, and then the following season they go back, they get relegated. Yeah. It's a hard league. But yeah, I think Charlton now, back in the time, I think they were up and coming, growing. They're again very good in the community, Charlton were.
Still are, I think, aren't they, from what I've read? So
very much
a community club, aren't they?
Okay.
We'll go a bit further down the road to the Eagles, Crystal Palace. When you think about yo-yo clubs in the 90s, the first club I think comes to your head is Sunderland, but you could be further from the truth. It's definitely Crystal Palace.
Yeah,
during the 1990 to 99 period, they had three promotions and three relegations. I mean, that's your ultimate yo-yo club, isn't it? I mean, they started the decade with Ian Wright, Mark Bright and Andy Gray. I mean, three fantastic players there, all England internationals. Well, there again, don't misquote me. I can't remember if Mark Bright played for England. Viewers might have to correct me on that. But Andy Gray and Ian Wright definitely did. But they were a fantastic trio. That was just slightly before my time. I mean, they played Man United in the 1999 FA Cup final. Paul, you might be able to remember that. All those three players played there. It was... I think, wasn't it the first game, the draw, the 2-2, was a classic, and then the replay midweek was shit. Something like that. I can vaguely remember it, mate.
Well, the replay is the famous Robins goal that saved Ferguson.
Robins, that's right, yeah.
Saved Ferguson from being sacked. So it was a big game under Ferguson, allegedly. Although Martin Edwards has come out and said that he was going to keep his job regardless, but easy to say in hindsight. But yeah, I don't remember a lot about him. I remember Antonio Lombardi.
That was mid-90s. I was just going to come on to them. Ian Wright, obviously, Arsenal took him away from Palace. Sheffield Wednesday took Mark Bright away from Palace. And Spurs took Andy Gray away. So they were left with basically no one, really. Just Cookie Coleman at the back. Going on to mid-90s, when we remember, you mentioned Lombardo. You had, this is the thing, right? Okay, listen to these. You had Lombardo, was half decent. He was good in Italy at Juventus, wasn't he, in Sampdoria. They got an overweight Thomas Brolin. Michel Padovano from Juventus. What happened there? Those three players really just didn't perform, did they? I mean, coming to the Premier League, Paul, I mean, we're massive fans of Italian football. They've all come from Italian football. I mean, Brolin's gone via Leeds, but we've always remarked on how good Italian football is. And we've spoke to Brian Dean and a couple of others about those certain players. Just why do you think, you know, stick with Crystal Palace, why do you think it just didn't settle? Why it didn't work for them?
Two reasons. One, they come over at the end of their career. It wasn't like they were coming in their prime. Three reasons. Two, they would have got more money coming over here at the time with the Premier League, giving out bigger contracts. And three, you don't get the time on the ball they would have been used to in those other countries. You know, people forget, you can name your Zolas, your Bergkamps and these players, but for every one of them, you could probably name five foreigners that were flops. Because you had to be truly exceptional at that stage to really, but to shine, you had to be pretty good. And you had to be under 27, realistically. How many foreigners came over at that point, stage at 30, 31, and then they just couldn't cut it? You know, the fitness might have been there, but the brutality of the league at the time, it wasn't. When you go to look at Juventus and Italy and Spain, it was a lot more less physical and a lot more time on the ball. When you come here, Bosch, listen, this is England. Welcome.
Yeah. Do you think that Palace was the wrong club for those three players I mentioned? Do you think that there just wasn't around good enough players to perform?
No.
Do you think that's a cop-out?
That's a cop-out. I think good players are good players regardless. Yes, of course, you can have a dip in form. Yes, of course, you might not... You don't hit the potential. Being around better players does make a difference. Of course it does.
It helps, doesn't it?
It does help. Of course it does. But your individual performance should still be of some sort of standard to hold you accountable to.
The weird thing is, I agree with this Lombardo thing. He's probably the best out of the three I mentioned. He was, you know, I think he was back in the 30s, and wild guess, but he looked old anyway, didn't he? Padovano thing, don't know what happened there. But the Brolin thing, to this day, Paul, still intrigues me, because we spoke to Brian Dean, and he couldn't really nail it down. He just said he didn't settle. But for someone that had that amount of ability playing in the Euros, World Cup USA 94, was that good for Parma, winning trophies, to come to play in the Premier League, which wasn't as good as Serie A at that time? I'm still no none the wiser. I can't understand how a player of that, I've never called him world class, borderline maybe at that time, how a guy can put that much weight on. I mean, it's got to be, what do you reckon, Jane? It's got to be, I mean, maybe Palace fans would be able to tell us. Well, I mean, what went wrong? I mean, if Brolin, when he went to United in 94, 95, do you think he would have gone, it put so much weight on, and do you think it would have been as bad as what he was at Leeds and Palace?
Yeah,
the Fergie effect. Yeah, do you think?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe what he's heart went. Maybe just he fell out of love with the game. Maybe he weren't that bothered. Because you could look at,
do you think playing around Roy Keane, Ryan Giggs, Paul Ince would not have made him think, right, hang on a minute, I can win European trophies, I can win leagues, I want X amount of money here, I could be a great. Do you not think
maybe
that? It's the Brolin effect, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah, but if he's not enjoying his football and not really bothered by it anymore, then that's what happens. It's like any job.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a waste, isn't it, really?
It is a waste, but as you said, he's won things in his career. He's played in major tournaments. Maybe in his mind, he had nothing else to achieve, and this was just a way to earn money at the end of it and didn't give a shit.
They actually won a trophy, a major trophy, if you can call it that. They won the full Members' Cup in 1991, beating Everton 4-1 at Wembley.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can educate me on this, Paul. I never even heard of it. It wasn't called the full Members' Cup. It was sponsored by Zenith Datas or something. I don't understand what that competition was, what it was for, but fair play to Palace. They got a bit of silverware in the 1990s. Do you remember that, mate?
I don't remember it. I remember doing research before. It was only around for about 7 years, was it? Is that 7-8 years?
85? Yeah, I don't really have a lot of memory about it.
Exactly. But I think it was done to try and launch another trophy. So there's the FA Cup and the League Cup, but we weren't in Europe. I'm sure for a large period that we weren't in Europe because we got
the Heysel thing, I think. Yeah. Then Man United had that thing about non-foreign rules. Yeah, yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I know where you're going.
I think the Four Members Cup was a cup for the members of the English League that went into it, and it was. That was there, that the extra games to replace, not to replace Europe, so teams had more games to play. But I might be wrong.
Okay. Yeah. I don't remember much about it, mate, to be honest. Yeah, but
what, Nottingham
Forest? Yeah, they had a trophy anyway, fair play to them. Say again.
Well, didn't Nottingham Forest win it as well? They won it a couple of times. Chelsea won that as well. I'm sure they did.
I'm not sure, mate. So my memory on that is very vague. It's not a thing I could really talk about. A bit like the Anglo-Italian Cup. I remember it existed, but I couldn't remember what the point of it was, you know. But anyway, yeah, we've kind of covered Palace, so we've got one more club to nail down now. Not so much South London, but South West London. That's a crazy gang. That's Wimbledon. I mean, I've got a soft spot for them. I always did back in those days. I've got a theory. Well, it's not so much a theory. I think it's fact, really. There's no right or wrong way to play football. At the end of the day, you've got to put the ball in the back of the net, no matter how you do it. It's 3 points in the day. Paul, Wimbledon, long ball merchants. Shit crowds, which there were 2,000 to 3,000. That's bad for Premier League football, even if it was in the early noughties. Our ball to play against, but they were just big, physical. I mean, when you look back at footage of years ago, you see Ferguson, George Graham, Wenger, you know, the manager, Ron, that big Ron. They look at when they're talking and say, "Well, blimey, we've got Wimbledon, or we've just played Wimbledon. What do you expect?" Didn't enjoy that. I wouldn't say a horrible team like Millwall. I think when you talk about Millwall, you think about their fans. But and even this day and age, I'd hate my side to play against Wimbledon. They're horrible, very physical, very elbowy, wouldn't they? What's your memories of Millwall in the night? Millwall, got them on the brain. What's your memories of Wimbledon in the '90s, Paul? Is it everything I've said, or can you add a bit more to that?
Yeah, no, that's pretty well. So I think my cousin was a supporter. Jordan was a Wimbledon fan. I remember a guy who used to go to his house and he had the things up, the posters up with the Wimbledon players back in the day and the scarves and stuff. So I remember watching, you know, obviously the Beckham goal against Wimbledon. Neil Sullivan, and we spoke about, a good goal. Do you know what? I think what was happening with Wimbledon, football was transitioning. Football was making a change. And Wimbledon were one of the clubs that were anti-establishment almost, anti-change.
It was working to an extent, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course it was. It was working very well, very effectively. You know, winning the trophy, you know, that's a massive coup.
It's hump the ball. It was get the ball to the two big men up the top. Well, at the time, it was Holdsworth, Akuku, and Don Fashanu.
Yeah.
It was knock the ball down and pump it in the back of the net. And it worked. It worked through that whole decade until the Norwegians took over, am I right?
That's what English football was. You know, of course, your Liverpools and your flair players and your... down football, but a lot of the teams were get it up top, get it in the channels, knock it in the box. That was English football to a degree. 92 to 98, it was changing. You had more kind of the foreign influences, the start of Wenger coming in, and then they kind of went away. But then you had like your Stokes taking the banner on and being that hard physical team. Now, I don't think there is a team that's like that now. It wouldn't get away from it. Well, Wimbledon play a game. If you take that Wimbledon team, put it in a game in 2021, that game ain't finishing because you're not going to have 11 players.
When you think of Fashanu, Holdsworth and Akuku, I don't know about you, Paul, but I think elbows. They're very elbowy. Do you know when you go up for the ball, the elbows are out, very physical side. Don't get me wrong. Don't misquote me. As in, they're not elbowing in the face. They use their elbows a lot. Ball at chest, put it down, knock it on, and score goals. Very kick and rush. Very boring to this day and age, but very effective. Very, very effective. And that's why they were in the Premier League for that amount of time.
Yeah.
The Norwegians came in, didn't they? You had Egil Olsen on his wellies. Oh, and you take up. They tried to change things, mate, and then they went down. I mean, they had money troubles, I know, but. When Kinnear went, was that and the Norwegians came in? I mean, look at now, they're actually Milton Keynes Dons, aren't they? You know, unfortunately.
Well, there's no such thing as Wimbledon. As you say, it's MK. Yeah. I mean, arguably, they're not Wimbledon, AFC Wimbledon or AFC Wimbledon. Wimbledon. So it went into split into factions almost, or it splintered off. Do you know what? Wimbledon, you say that. I think the difference is we've mentioned all these other clubs, and we can mention players of class, of some degree of class. You know, Lombardi at Palace and players at West Ham. There's all these people you can think, oh, they were class. When you think of Wimbledon, you don't think anyone there was a great footballer.
Yeah, I agree. There was there. Let's be fair. You know, you bang on.
So I think that's the difference. Effective, yes. Style of play, brutal, yes. Did you know you had a game against Wimbledon? Yes. Did they beat teams in the tunnel? Yes. You know, all these things, but it was never going to be sustainable in football as football was transitioning. But in that period, more successful than QPR. In that period, arguably more successful than Tottenham. And how much did Wimbledon
I agree.
Compared to all these other clubs? You know, so history can't be changed. They won an FA Cup. It was one of the greatest FA Cup wins in FA Cup history. And they did it their way. And I think that as a club, I know that you said a relatively small fan base.
And the early 90s, they did. Yeah. They were having crowds between 2,000 and 3,000, Paul. I mean, that's pretty bad. That's what I was going to come on to next. Do you think they were punching above their weight? Even if they were in the top league of English football, were they punching above their weight because they were beating big teams as well?
It depends what you mean by punching above their weight, because they
well, basically, should they have gone down straight away? But they won. They stayed in there in a 10-year period, didn't they? You know,
well, they stayed there because they're good enough. That's it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. That's the expression you use, isn't it? Punching above their weight. They shouldn't have been in there, but they were. They did enough to stay there.
I think when
you
punch above your weight, you punch above your weight for a season or two because you're thinking, oh, you know, they've been up there a few.
Yeah, that's that's a good. I agree with that. That's quite a good analysis.
And they weren't a yo-yo club, Wimbledon. They were in the Premier League.
No.
Do you know what I mean? That's an achievement in itself. And I think people are quick to forget how good they were in that period at what they did, you know?
Yeah. But you did say about the quality of players they had. So really, I agree. They didn't have any class at all, did they? I was going to ask you, my favourite player from the 90s of Wimbledon, the first thing, I used to like big John Fashanu, but he moved to Aston Villa, I think, in the mid-90s. But Robbie Earl, I mean, he was probably their best player that actually had a bit of class. Yeah. Was the world class, don't get me wrong. But, they didn't have any outstanding players, did they? But that's what I meant. I didn't mean to be offensive to them, but, you know, that's what I mean about punching above their weight. They had no one, but they were still doing a job consistently over a 10-year period.
The last one that came through was it Carlton? Carlton?
Carl Colt. Yeah, but they, straight away, Newcastle snatched him, didn't they?
Yeah. And I think that was it. That was the beginning of the end Carl Colt kind of come through and they got snapped up. Is that what their model's broken because they can't even evolve to become something different because they're not the ability to keep any players that show any quality. They're going to always be stolen away. But Egil Olsen's bullies, I forgot about them. Oh, God.
Yeah, it's iconic, isn't it? Unfortunately, Wimbledon fans won't thank you for it. But it's like we said, that's the start of the end. But that's we have a good insight there to London clubs in the 90s, mate. It's been great. So obviously, I had a little mini quiz prepared for the lads. I've still got it here in front of me. We're not going to do it, obviously, to an extent. But I've got a couple of players here. If you just like to answer them, there's a couple of curveballs in here. Basically, from 92 to 99, I've written a few players down. And see if you can tell me what club they played for during 92 to 99. What's London club? It's a London-based quiz, okay? So just to finish off this episode, so in between 92 and 99, Paul Parker, who did he play for?
QPR.
That's right, it's a curveball. In the Premier League era, he played for Chelsea.
Did he really?
Yeah, yeah. That's mad. Mate, I had to Google that. Paul Parker, he left QPR when it was the old First Division, went to Manchester United. He came to my boys, Fulham, for a couple of games, and he played for Chelsea, I think like in 97, 98.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to go with that. Here's another one for you. John Barnes.
Watford.
Who John Barnes played?
Charlton,
yeah. I didn't think you'd get that. Yeah, he played for Charlton. Well done. Let's have another one. Pat van der Hau. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
Yeah, what London club did you play for?
Were they a Premier League club?
Yeah.
They were.
Oh, Premier League. Yeah.
Well,
Pat van der Hau sounds Dutch, but he was Welsh, didn't he? Played for Wales.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Palace.
No, Spurs. I'll give you one more because he's for everyone. So he's another curveball as well. David Rowcastle. God rest his soul. Rocky.
Arsenal. We know we played at.
That's the thing. The first couple people think it was Arsenal. He's gone years before. Then he played for Chelsea.
Another one.
Mate, I didn't know that. It's only because I was doing a bit of research for the quiz. Roque Arsenal, Chelsea. Nah, I don't remember that. Done a bit, of, you know, when you go into Google looking at images, you think, actually, that does ring a bell, but I don't remember him playing. So, yeah, there's a few curveballs there. So, me and Paul have given a bit of analysis on London clubs in the 90s. Hopefully, all you guys that are listening, your club's been involved. But if they're not, hopefully, we'll talk about your Millwalls, your Brentfords, your My Boys, your Fulhams, your Orients, etc. in the near future. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a note to our Instagram and Twitter accounts and our latest quiz, our episode of which I've renamed the Danny Blanchflower Trophy. That'll be going live soon. That's available on Spotify, on Apple, and other podcasts, any other podcasts that are available. We're normally on there anyway. So, like I say, hope you enjoyed it. Take care. We'll see you soon. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Podcast Network. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.